Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. Here it is Tuesday, September 17, 2013. And it was 2 years ago this week that Occupy protesters took over Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan. Is it over?
In this proud land, we grew up strong. We were wanted all along. I was taught to fight, taught to win. I never thought I could fail.
Don't give up, 'cause you have friends. Don't give up, you're not beaten yet.
2 years after, the events in New York led to Occupy encampments and protests all across the USA. It's hard to measure what the impact has been and if there is any residual force in the Occupy movement that we may see resurface in the future or in some other form. And so as I look back, it is with mixed feelings because I was really energized by these people who came really from all different corners of life to coalesce and to take on the impact of income and wealth inequality in the United States. And they performed an important function kind of as a counterweight to the Tea Party movement. It was not explicitly a progressive or Democratic Party effort, but overlapped with some of the issues that are important to those groups. But ultimately, the design or the failure of Occupy to avoid taking political positions, to avoid issuing some sort of a manifesto or a list of demands, left it as something that was aspirational and never fully achieved. Now, to be fair, the Obama administration used the mechanisms of the Department of Homeland Security to relentlessly monitor Occupy, to infiltrate it, claiming that it could be violent, that it could lead to terrorism, and therefore they had the authority to do so. And as reporter Bo Hodai has shared with our listeners in the past, they made a conscious effort to infiltrate Occupy, gather information about their protest movements, and then share that with the targets of Occupy, the banks and other corporate entities, through their private security operations. And I view this as a fundamental violation of the First Amendment and the rights of Occupy protesters to express themselves as they did. But this has gone unnoticed and unaddressed by most media, most elected officials. And I think that's one of the real tragedies of what is the legacy of Occupy. In an in-depth interview that'll be released shortly at peterbcollins.com, I talked with Sam Daly Harris, a longtime activist going back to the 1980s. He's taken on little issues like hunger and poverty, now climate change. And I asked him for his comments about Occupy, and here's a quick excerpt.
Let me say it this way. Camping out or really successful mouse clicks are good strategy for getting attention. But you're not going to alter the direction of climate change or end global poverty or income inequality by camping out or mouse clicks. Those are deeper systemic issues that demand deeper systemic strategies. Don't stop the protest and don't stop the clicking, but don't stop there. Exactly. But Paul Loeb, the author of The Soul of a Citizen, said, you know, those emails are counted in congressional offices, but they're also discounted. And so we need to step beyond that.
The full interview with activist Sam Daly Harris will be released soon at peterbcollins.com. If you're not a subscriber, I would encourage you to step up and support our work here. Mona Kobus did it. Carl Harrison did. Peter Van Dyke's a supporter. Donna Metzger, she signed up for $5 a month subscription. And you can do it too. All you have to do is go to peterbcollins.com and follow the links under my picture on the upper left-hand corner of the homepage. It's easy. That $5 a month subscription you can cancel anytime, or the best deal is $50 for our annual subscription. And new annual subscribers, as you may know, qualify for a bonus bag of Kona coffee that came all the way from the Big Island of Hawaii and Russ Archibald and his friends there on the farm. I also have a few copies of Sybelle Edmonds' Classified Woman as our bonus book. Get them while they last. That's with your new annual subscription. And you can also steer your business to GoDaddy.com, and they'll split a little bit off for me. That's how it works here. All you have to do is sign up for new web hosting. They offer unlimited storage and bandwidth, starting at just $1.99 a month, and they'll throw in your domain name free. To get a special deal and a super discount that supports the Peter B. Collins Show, follow the GoDaddy link in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Well, the dreaded American Civil Liberties Union is at it again, fighting for our constitutional rights. They have a new 60-plus page report about the FBI. And it is blistering. With a new director taking over, James Comey, he sailed to confirmation. There was only one little love fest hearing. No one challenged him about how he's going to rein in this rogue agency, how he's going to control the use of national security letters, which the Inspector General of the FBI has frequently reported are widely abused. And what about, as Bo Hodai reported to us, the 15,000 paid informants who are out there in the field, many of them infiltrating Muslim groups here in the United States? That's just the tip of the FBI iceberg. Then we've got the killing by an FBI agent of the fellow named Ibrahim Todashev, who was related to the accused brothers of the Boston Marathon bombing. And he was being interrogated and forced to sign a confession in his apartment in Orlando, Florida, when he was shot and killed by an FBI agent. And that, of course, is one of many uses of force by the FBI. Everyone that has been investigated has been declared justified. So I'm right behind the ACLU on this, and the FBI skates. They especially in the summer of leaks, with all the attention on the NSA, the FBI is kind of off the radar and getting away with a lot. And I'm glad the ACLU has published this study. I mentioned yesterday that I spent last week in Brazil. It was fascinating. I met a lot of interesting people. And almost to a person, they were very concerned about the U.S. spying on Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff. Also, while I was there, it was revealed that the NSA has been targeting the state oil company of Brazil for surveillance, monitoring, economic espionage. And this has produced a backlash. President Dilma Rousseff of Brazil had been scheduled to come to Washington for a state visit, the first of Obama's second term, on October 23rd. But she notified the White House that she's canceling that visit in protest over U.S. spying. And she met with Obama in St. Petersburg, Russia, at the G20 summit, and apparently had a very frank conversation with the superpower leader, who said that he regrets the spying on an ally and said he's going to investigate it fully. And I joked with my friends in Brazil last week that if Dilma Rousseff really wanted to send a message to the White House, she should not publicly cancel her visit. She should just send one email to a friend or her husband or a security detail person saying that she's canceling the trip and let Obamaco find out through its spies at the NSA. Well, there is massive coverage, way too much coverage, in my opinion, of the shooting in Washington, D.C. at the Navy Yard on Monday. And yes, this is a national tragedy and a national event. I accept that. But after a while, the constant coverage of a single story like this gets really tiresome. What I'd like to point out is that we know that the Navy reservist who is fingered for the shooting, 34-year-old Aaron Alexis, has a long history of mental illness. And yet, he has been holding a secret clearance. His employer, a defense contractor, said that he wasn't aware of the history of Aaron Alexis, and since he held this security clearance, that he went ahead and hired him, and he was either just about to start or recently started in a position there at the massive Navy Yard facility in Washington. And this points out once again that while the national security state has focused its attention on monitoring the behavior of innocent people who pose no threat to our national security, we have expanded the ranks of those who have secret and top-secret clearances. And we're led to believe that these people are all fully investigated and vetted, some cases by the good old FBI. But they certainly missed one here. And, of course, they'll find ways to shift the blame to avoid any closer scrutiny. You have to go to the Chinese news service Xinhua to get this information, leaking from Pakistan, that the United States intends to keep about 20,000 American and NATO troops in Afghanistan after we withdraw, that's in air quotes, from the country, which is scheduled to occur by the end of next year. Now, there are negotiations underway, and it's complicated because our puppet leader there, Afghan President Hamid Karzai, says he won't run for re-election as the president, and they opened the nomination process, so to speak, the balloting, and so far no one has stepped up to run for president of Afghanistan. But I think this is an important tip to keep in mind, because Obama gets a complete pass on Afghanistan. He twice escalated our troop strength there. We still have somewhere around 100,000 contractors that we're paying for on the ground in Afghanistan. And the American public is just so passive about this continuing war and the hopeless nature of it. Yet there is no pressure on Obama to remove all American troops or to get the process of withdrawal sped up. I find that fascinating and disturbing equally. Well, as if Fukushima has not had enough problems, Typhoon Manyi hit Japan on Monday, leaving two people dead and forcing the operator of the crippled Fukushima plant to release rainwater with, they say, low levels of radiation into the ocean. Now, we have very little confidence in the representations of TEPCO, the utility operator. The Japanese government is intervening now to try to take charge of the mess at Fukushima, but this is a pro-nuclear government of Abe. And, again, there's very little confidence internationally about Japan's response. And so this typhoon is just another setback for the situation in Fukushima, Japan. Interesting op-ed that led Sunday's New York Times opinion section by Professor Ian Lustig, professor of political science, University of Pennsylvania. And it refers to the long-running efforts to craft a two-state solution between Israel and Palestine. And over the past year, I have presented a number of Israeli voices on this program, all who say the two-state solution is dead. And that because Israel has so aggressively expanded settlements into the West Bank, into Palestinian territory, and because Israel essentially refuses to give up those settlements, the only way forward, in the opinion of many observers, is a one-state solution, where Israel must become more than a Jewish state, more than a state designed to protect the Jewish majority. Now, that causes a whole set of ripple effects that throw the Israelis into a tizzy as well. But I think it's worth studying this issue. And I, of course, do not consider myself more expert than the Palestinians on these matters. But if the Palestinians are willing to consider a one-state solution, I would support moving the negotiations in that direction. And I've been saving this story since September 5th, Associated Press. They got some of the peace talkers, the Israeli and Palestinian representatives, to break their silence. They've been trying to keep a lid on any public comments, and we don't know that much. Talks resumed in late July after a five-year break, and we're told that they have been meeting on a regular basis. But some Palestinians went public complaining that Israel has proposed leaving intact dozens of those Jewish settlements and military bases in the West Bank as part of a peace package. If that's the case, then these peace talks aren't going to go very far. Meanwhile, Benjamin Netanyahu will descend in New York for the annual UN festivities next week, and we're told in advance that he is planning to bring his red crayons and focus on the threat of a nuclear Iran. Is this Groundhog Day, Bibi? I think we've heard this spiel before, and we've seen you get out that crayon and draw a red line. And after Obama's red line experience, maybe you'll think twice about that. Our friend and contributor to this program, Steve Horn, is a prolific researcher and writer. And his latest report that I'll link to for you, it's at DSmog blog, says that you should beware of a new study surfacing that has the stamp of the Environmental Defense Fund on it, that studies the leakage of gas from fracked wells. During fracking, one of the big complaints of environmentalists is that gas escapes from the wellhead and that this methane offsets any benefits of using natural gas, say, to generate electricity as compared to coal. And it makes fracking for so-called clean natural gas a dirtier process. Well, this new study, as Horn points out, was conducted in a very friendly way, friendly to the industry. And it concludes that a mere 0.42% of fracked gas is emitted into the air at the well. And this is 2 to 4% lower than well pad emissions estimated by Cornell University professors in a study that was published in April of 2011. And so Horn interviewed Professor Robert Howarth, one of the co-authors of the Cornell study a couple of years ago, and said, well, take a look at this study. It's based only on evaluation of sites and times chosen by the industry, so it must be viewed as a best-case scenario. And he went on to say, many other scientists have proven over the past 2 years that you can measure methane emissions from gas without industry cooperation. For instance, by using aircraft to fly over operations. But they didn't do that in this case. And he says that the study also didn't do a life cycle analysis, and that this is one that is what Horn has dubbed fracademia, which is the unholy alliance of corporate and academic interests to promote fracking, despite the clear indications of the risk it poses to the environment, the methane leaks, the massive uses of water, the poisoning of groundwater from the fracking effluent, and on and on. There is a new bubble building over ethanol credits as Wall Street speculators have driven up the value of ethanol credits by almost a factor of 20. And as companies who qualify for the credits go to purchase them, there is essentially a market-based extortion that is being imposed. So, for example, the Valero Energy Corporation, a refiner that owns thousands of gas stations, says the squeeze in ethanol credits might cost it $800 million. And that's a matter of pure profit-taking, or shall we call it greed, on the part of Wall Street. When you talk about seceding from the United States, most of us immediately think of Texas and loonies like Rick Perry. Well, there is a movement to secede from California on the part of a number of counties that border on the Oregon border. They are close to the Oregon border, not all exactly border counties, but one or two counties in. And they are proposing to secede from California and encourage some of the southern Oregon counties to secede from Oregon to form the 51st state of Jefferson. And the Siskiyou County Board of Supervisors, that's in far northern California, recently voted 4-1 to study the idea of secession. And this is not actually new, because there have been proposals in the past. There's a guy named Stan Statham. He used to be a state senator from far north California. And Stan Statham floated a proposal in the mid-1990s to split California into three different states because of our population and because of the diverse interests of different regions of California. And it didn't go very far, but I think it's an interesting idea. It would certainly give us more clout, for example, in the United States Senate, where we would have six senators compared to the two that currently represent more than 33 million people. So I think this is interesting, and I don't take it as a slap in the face to the rest of us here in California. I think that it actually might make some sense in the long run, and I hope that they will pursue their dream and see where it all leads. And finally today, I want to pay tribute to 67-year-old Linda Ronstadt.
Feeling better now that we're through. Feeling better cause I'm over you. I learned my lesson and left a scar. Now I see how you really are.
Linda Ronstadt has a new book coming out, and in advance of that, she sat for an interview with the San Francisco Chronicle. She lives here in San Francisco itself, quietly, low-key, rarely recognized as she runs around. And she reveals that she can no longer sing due to the advance of Parkinson's disease. And while, you know, that's a real setback for her, she doesn't display any sense of self-pity or that sort of thing. And I think she's remarkable. I'll link to the article in case you're a Linda Ronstadt fan and you'd like to read it for yourself. But it recaps her life as a musician, all the different great people she's performed with, and her personal life as well. She never married. She used to hang out with Jerry Brown when he was governor the first time. They took a famous trip to Africa. She was the girlfriend of Star Wars filmmaker George Lucas for many years. But she describes how she doesn't really need a man. And I think that's really worth listening to, even as a man. Thanks for joining me for this podcast today. Your comments are always welcome. Drop me an email, Peter@peterbcollins.com.